What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Jesse Berger spent over 10 years working with large financial institutions in Canada, including roles in retail banking, investment advisory, management consulting, and market research. He graduated from McGill University in 2006, having studied economics and philosophy, and he received his MBA from Ryerson University in 2015. There he led the winning team of the Economist MBA Investment Case Competition, topping more than 25 schools from around the world. In 2018, he became a certified blockchain professional, and he is currently an independent consultant based in Toronto, author of the Magic Internet Money, a book about Bitcoin. Welcome to the show, Jesse. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Yeah, it gets confusing between the website URL of Magic Bitcoin Book and a book about Bitcoin and Magic Internet Money. It can all get mixed in there.
Yeah, man. I love the book. I bought a couple of copies.
There it is. You got the physical copy.
Yeah, man. I highlighted the shit out of them. I really enjoyed them. You know, I really think that they kind of magically disseminate a ton of historical facts and quotes and Bitcoin knowledge in really like short, concise thoughts, chapters that build seamlessly on each other. And you know, by the third of the way in the book, it's a page turner. I'm really starting to really enjoy it more than just the facts and the knowledge that you drop, but these quotes that you use to stitch the book together really bring a lot of insight and provoke a lot of thought.
Yeah, man. I was very focused on I wanted the book to be, you know, enjoyable. I wanted the reader to really not just learn something from it, but to sort of have a good time. So I have, you know, little hat tips towards magic and the wizard and everything. And I've injected a lot of Bitcoin culture into the book.
Yeah. I mean, what's the wizardry and the magic, you know, it's a different angle for me just in terms of genre. I'm usually not reading a lot of books about sci-fi or magic or wizardry, but it really brings a whimsical nature to the book. It just made it more compelling in a different way, made it a little lighter at times when you're going over some of these kind of deeper concepts. And I really think the book is for everybody.
That was the goal for me. And, you know, everyone who I spoke to about writing a book would tell me, well, you're crazy. You can't write a book for everyone. That's, you know, a surefire way to fail. But from my perspective, Bitcoin's for everyone. So the book should be for everyone.
Right. Yeah. And I think that you accomplished that in spades. At first, you know, you're really building like kind of the context and the outline around money and Bitcoin. And then you're taking the reader through a very, I think, kind of introspective ride about money.
Yeah, I tried to turn, you know, my experience, my knowledge set that I've sort of accumulated and built up myself over, you know, my career to date. I tried to, you know, condense that and just make it so that someone could sort of seamlessly catch up to where I am right now.
Right.
So that we could, you know, set a new floor, let's call it, for Bitcoin knowledge in the world.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your background a bit. I mean, it's varied, but, you know, the credentials are there. And I think that you do through this book that kind of like, I love the artwork too, and how that kind of plays with the story. But you're really getting an investment case across as well, I think very subtly.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's no like buy Bitcoin or like, you know, you need to spend this much or do this thing. But you outline that really well. So, you know, I mean, what compelled you to write the book? And I'm really kind of saying like, you know, what was your goals for the book in terms of like for the reader to get across?
Yeah. So it's not the hard sell of, you know, go buy Bitcoin. I think if you understand Bitcoin, then, you know, that sort of takes care of itself. So if you can wrap your head around all the ideas or a bunch of the ideas and then slowly wrap your head around more and more and more, inevitably you'll lead yourself to the conclusion that I should probably buy some Bitcoin. Right. This thing's probably going to be, you know, worthwhile to hold on to, even if, you know, you don't have to go all in, you don't have to be irresponsibly long. But for those that can or know that it's the right thing to do, you know, by all means, of course. But yeah, I wanted to get people sort of caught up to speed is one way to think about it on everything that's going on in the world of Bitcoin and the culture of Bitcoin and the ideas and the arguments backing it. It's because it's not just about, you know, buy because number's going to go up. Like, yeah, all of us think that. But, you know, Bitcoin, if it achieves what it can possibly, you know, potentially achieve, then it's going to be, you know, the best thing to ever happen to the world. But you'll never know it if you just think, well, I'm going to buy it because it's a speculative thing and it might go up.
Right.
It's if we're going to make it so that we one day work on a Bitcoin standard and Bitcoin becomes, you know, our preferred basis for commerce in the world, as that basis, it will lead to very positive social and economic outcomes that are just going to have benefits that we can't even imagine yet.
Right.
So yeah, so I, you know, how do I get all of that very heavy idea across in something a little bit lighter? So I had to, you know, you be a little creative to get that message across and frame certain arguments.
Yeah,
yeah,
it was very creative, so, and we're going to get into the book in a little bit. You know, going back to 2006, you're getting your MBA. Well, actually, so you're at McGill, which, from what I remember being in school, that's like, and I was in the States, but that's like the best school in Canada.
It's considered basically one of the top programs.
Yeah, like the Harvard of Canada. And then, then you go on to get your MBA at Ryerson and you do this competition, you know, with the magazine, The Economist. And what do you think you learned from that? Or what was that experience like? What'd you draw?
Yeah, that was actually a lot of fun for me. That was like the perfect capstone to my year as an MBA student. Like I had this, you know, sort of Cinderella year when I was in my MBA. It's, you know, I don't think a lot of people probably talk about their year as an MBA student as much as I do. I just had this crazy, amazing, great year where I was just saying yes to anything that came my way, even if I had no idea if I was well suited for it. It was just like, say yes to the new experience, try out new opportunities, and, you know, we'll see what happens. And so, yeah, that case, funny enough, I haven't talked about it before, but the judges, I'll backtrack just for one second.
Sure.
Every year, for a few years there, I don't know if they're still doing it, The Economist magazine had this investment-themed case competition where you would get a whole bunch of schools from around the world to put together both an essay and a video, and you had a couple weeks to do it all. And, you know, the year that I did it, it just so happened that Real Vision was sponsoring the case and Raoul Pal and Grant Williams were the judges.
Oh, wow.
And I had, like, I remember reading all of Grant's, like, things that make you go, newsletters, you know, going back for years and years. I had watched him and Raoul give various presentations and, you know, I've seen their names all over financial media outlets for years and years because I worked in retail banking and investment management leading up to that. So when I saw that they were the judges, instantly I was like, okay, it's game time. I know a little bit, at least, about the way these guys think, what they want. I'm going to sort of design this big story arc. If you've ever seen any of Grant's presentations on YouTube, he's got a whole bunch of them.
I'm so more familiar with Raoul,
So Grant has this newsletter called Things That Make You Go Hmm, which I don't actually know if it's still active. I hope it is. But in any event, he always told a story that overlapped with the actual content of his newsletter. And he would do the same thing with his presentation. So for us, we had this tortoise versus the hare story because the case had to do with Amazon versus Walmart. Mm. So, you know, Amazon being the hare and Walmart being the tortoise.
Interesting.
And yeah. So we had this sort of overarching story on top of our analysis. And I threw in a whole bunch of macroeconomics into the picture and into the actual analysis itself to sort of get their attention. And, you know, it worked beautifully. They crowned us the champs.
Right.
The people who, like, because all the videos and all the essays were posted to The Economist's website. So the viewers and the visitors to their website also voted us like the People's Champs, the People's Choice Award, whatever. So it was like a sweep for us. It was a huge deal for the school. It was a huge deal for me personally,
yeah,
you know, my professional life. And yeah, so that was like just one super, super cool experience where I was just kind of the right guy in the right place at the right time. Like there's no way any of those other students had anywhere near the exposure I had to the judges. So that sort of played in our favor, but like we put together an amazing analysis. Our video is still up. The video is actually really cool. My friend Kristen, who was on the team. She did the video part of it as and also a lot of the research and everything as well. We just, you know, the team worked super well together. We had an amazing time. Like, we had a fun time. It was really hectic because it was 2 weeks to do the essay and then another week after that to do the video.
Yeah. Do you remember what some of the maybe the arguments of the case for Amazon was back in 2006? I know that's a long time to draw on.
Yeah, it was the case for, so I remember, I'll tell you, I remember what we finished up, what our sort of final solution was. We, final solution is a bad word, I shouldn't say that. What our solution was to the case. We basically came out saying that, okay, we project Walmart might come out a little bit below Amazon if we're projecting 10 years into the future of what their stock price is going to be worth. But we viewed it as a safer play. And because you had to make an investment using both those stocks, I remember thinking, well, you know, we could do some kind of crazy rolling options deal, but like how that's going to be so complicated. How are we ever going to justify that? We could do something like 50-50, but that's a total cop-out and not a real answer. So at the end of the day, we sort of just decide, all right, we think, yeah, Amazon's going to come out ahead, but Walmart is probably the safer play. So let's incorporate both. We'll just weight it way more heavily to Walmart. So we had an 80-20 split, and then we sort of showed the projection of their both stock prices in a portfolio and the dividends if they accumulated. So that, I think, got the judge's attention because it was a very simple solution. It was sort of simple and elegant. And that's, I think, part of what probably helped us out. But yeah, in terms of all the arguments, I mean, there was a lot that went into it. I can't go into all the rationale, but there was a lot that went into it.
Yeah, there was a lot there that I'm already makes me think about, like, just how, in that case, I see it as Bitcoin versus fiat. So Amazon has already gone through like 290% drawdowns by that point. You know, it's not making money maybe in terms of net positive revenue cash flows or net income. But, you know, it is the hair. It is the more well-built system versus the old behemoth maybe.
Yeah, I mean, the difference, I would say, in our analysis of Amazon versus Walmart is, you know, they both had their strengths and they both had reason that, you know, they should be around in 10 years and 20 years, whatever it is. Walmart had this huge real estate, you know, physical footprint, whereas Amazon was obviously very nimble and doing most of their deliveries online, and they didn't have a very heavy physical footprint. And one was making, you know, Walmart was slowly making forays into, you know, the e-tailer online shopping space. I think they had bought, is it called Jet at the time or just after our case? I think they had bought Jet, which was, I think, sort of similar to Costco, if I'm not mistaken. I forget exactly. And meanwhile, Amazon's opened a couple. I know in Seattle, they had this, you know, pick your groceries right off the shelf. You don't have to pay, just shove it in the thing and out you go, and it will scan everything for you. So they're both sort of slowly blurring together. So it's been interesting to sort of see that play out.
Yeah.
And, you know, every now and then I'm chatting with the group about, oh, you know, I wonder if our portfolio will actually work out, if we should have flipped it the other way. Amazon's kind of way ahead right now. But yeah, it, like, fiat versus Bitcoin is a completely different animal because fiat is just this sinking ship that's, you know, they're just grasping at straws right now.
Right.
Whereas Bitcoin was, you know, Bitcoin is just built super solid from the ground up and is just gaining more and more momentum as she goes.
Right. Yeah. And then somehow you bet and played your way to the World Series of Poker.
I did. Yes. You want me to go into that one?
Yeah. What'd you learn there? What was that experience like?
So gambling and, you know, whether it was poker or blackjack, it's sort of been in my family for a long time. My grandfather had this saying. He goes, he goes, we come from a long line of gamblers and horse thieves, but we never stole the horses. The horses just followed us home. That was his line always. I played blackjack and poker sort of with my parents jokingly as a kid. I was sort of taught the ropes of those games. And so I won my way into the main event the first year I was eligible in 2006. And that was when poker was becoming a big craze. And so that was sort of a really cool step for me, especially as, you know, I was 21. I knew nothing about the world. I'm just sort of getting my feet wet. So to be able to go down to Vegas and play with, you know, you go into a huge conference room that's just poker tables as far as the eye can see. And the room is humming with chips. It was definitely intimidating. And I I lasted, you know, a day, busted out my first, I busted out, you know, 8 or 9 hours into the day. I was completely card dead. My first, so first day of the main event, but prior to that, I had been on this hot streak where I'd like either won or come, top two or three in a couple tournaments consecutively. So in my head, I was like, well, like I'll probably make it to the last day or two. Like I'm doing really well. So I planned on spending like 12 days in Vegas, which in retrospect was the worst decision I've ever made because I was completely broke by the end of the trip. Like literally day one in town, you know, I play for a day and I'm bust. And then I have like, okay, my buddy is with me for a couple of days. And then I got another buddy coming for a couple of days. And I'm sort of just having, you know, if you want to call it, I guess a roommate or someone to, you know, be by my side and cheer me on while I was playing. But yeah, busted out day one and then broke the bank, lost, you know, lost my shirt for those, remaining 11 days. But I went back the next couple of years in a row and just sort of bought into smaller tournaments because I continued to play online and did it. You know, I didn't make any serious money, but it was like enough that, okay, I was positive and I could afford to do it. And I was, you know, I knew, I was young. I was actually living at home at the time. So I'm like, okay, I don't have rent. Like this is, if there's a time to take some risk, like this is a good time for me. So yeah, so did it for a couple of years. I had one good finish where I finished 88th out of 3,000 players. Which was top 3% in a World Series event. So like my name is, you know, I've cashed in the World Series. Technically I didn't, you know, I think I made $5,000 or something that tournament, and I'm sure I lost it within a few months of that. But yeah, no, I had a nice little career in the poker world. I actually got to see Phil Hellmuth bust out of my table.
Really?
One time. Yeah, you want to hear that one?
Sure.
So do you play poker?
I mean, like you, I grew up playing poker with the family, just you know, the five of us, and we would play for sweet and low packets or sugar packets, or pennies or nickel dime, and it just. It was beyond the money. I mean, the money was just proving who was right and who won and who was wrong and who bluffed who. And that had some factor, but like, it was just great to be with the family and learn the game of poker and some of the lessons that you draw from it. I don't go to the casinos now, but you know, when I do,
no, I don't.
I go maybe to Vegas like once every 10 years and I'll have a blast. So
I play, like I play poker.
But I love
with my
poker
buddies.
Stories. And you were at the World Series of Poker with Phil Helms. So how often do I get to hear about that?
All right, so here's what happened, and this is 100% true, and it's seared into my brain because I've told this story 100 times now. So it's halfway through this. It was actually this tournament that I did well in, that I finished 88th out of 3,000. So we're halfway through the tournament. So it was about 3 days that the tournament lasted. And as players get knocked out, right, they fold one table into another. They're dissolving tables so that we're constantly filling up tables. So Phil Hellmuth ends up being sent over to my table. And for, I'll say this for the benefit of those that are listening who may not know who Phil Hellmuth is. Phil Hellmuth, his nickname is the Poker Brat. He's like that cocky guy who, everything he touches turns to gold, or at least he likes to think so. And I guess to a degree he can, because he's actually won the most World Series bracelets on the circuit. So, I mean, he really is, you know,
one of the best.
Very big deal on the poker world. Yeah, he's one of the best. So he gets folded into my table. He puts his chips down on the table. But before he takes a seat, he walks around and he shakes everyone's hand at the table. But he doesn't introduce himself because everyone's supposed to know who Phil is, because that's how Phil rolls, right? So he sits down at the table. As soon as he sits down, he calls over someone. You know, she's massaging his shoulder for like an hour and a half, right? Just the whole time he's sitting there, you know. I don't know what they're charging, but regardless, you know, he's getting the massage while he's playing the game. It's a good deal for him. And this one guy who's sitting to my left is jawing with Phil just the whole time, just giving him hell. I don't know if he's a pro or semi-pro or if he's played with him a whole bunch before, but he's just giving him shit. And so finally, Phil is under the gun. So he's the first to act and he's got pocket kings. And so he makes a raise. Everyone folds. I fold. It comes to the guy who to my left, who was talking, right? He was talking smack to Phil. So this guy raises Phil. Everyone folds, the blinds get out of the way. So now these two are heads up, cards aren't up yet. Phil makes a re-raise. Guy who was talking smack was sitting there and thinking for a little bit because, okay, you know, Phil made that raise under the gun and now he re-raised my raise. So he's not messing around. You know, he's probably got something. I got to think about it. Phil is sitting there. He's got sunglasses on. He's just got his hands sort of, you know, up against his face, giving away nothing. Eventually, the guy goes all in. The second the guy goes all in, Phil just splashes, shoves his chips on the pot, splat, you know, it's sort of against poker etiquette to do it, but he was just sitting baiting. He was waiting for him to do it, right? So of course they flip over. Phil's got his pocket kings. This guy's got pocket jacks, right? So Phil's got him crushed. Flop comes, 4-5 jack. Turn card, it's another jack. Phil's buried, you know, quads, you know, to his pair of kings. And so he stands up and he just looks around. He looks at the table. He looks at the dealer and he goes, I played the hand to perfection, and just walks away with a smug smile on his face.
Damn. So you outlasted the poker brat?
I outlasted Phil in the tournament.
Very cool.
Yes,
that is an incredible story. That was awesome. You know, okay, what kind of poker player then are you?
I'm pretty straightforward. I don't get too crazy. The only thing I try to do is I like playing live way better than online, because live, when you can see the person, like you get a lot of information. If you're paying attention, you can start to deduce some things. And so because I knew that I was paying very close attention to my opponents, my shtick was I would very purposely try to sort of mess with their head. So if I had sunglasses, I would just sort of take them on and off every 10 minutes, whether I was in the hand or not. It didn't really matter. I one time had this guy literally goes to me. He goes, whoa, why'd you just put on your sunglasses? You're not in this hand. And so I looked him straight in the eye and I go, just to fuck with you.
Right.
And right away, he, you know, light bulbs are going off in his head, like, funny. Oh shit, I was paying attention to his sunglasses.
Right.
Meanwhile, he's trying to get info from me. Like,
yeah, yeah.
So yeah, you got to be cerebral at the table.
I'm wondering, would patient have been any word that you would have used to describe yourself at the table?
Oh yeah, you got to pick your spots. Like poker, you know, poker on TV is one thing because, like, you know, you're editing and you're just seeing action. But if you're playing live in a tournament, those are 12, 13 hour days. You got to really be patient.
Right. So around this time, I don't know if it was maybe the exact time the great financial crisis. I'm not sure. You know, I'm guessing that had a big impact on your lens of the world and the economy.
Very much so. Yeah. I sort of got the short version is I got red pilled on Austrian economics and libertarianism to a certain degree in 2007 as I was working, you know, on the bottom rung of, you know, the retail banking ladder in Canada. And so as a retail banker, I would say I had some time on my hands. It's not the most exciting job. And I spent a lot of my free time just reading articles, reading books online. I was straight up re-educating myself after my initial, you know, education from McGill, where I majored in economics, and yet I didn't quite feel I could wrap my head around anything actually happening in the world. And Austrian economics just gave me this perspective to look at the world through. And it, you know, I feel like I can rationalize things now better than I could back then. And it's because of that perspective.
Mm. Yeah, I didn't come across Austrian economics before Bitcoin. It just really piques my interest that when people come to it and kind of grip it, because we are all taught very different things, you know, in the MBA schools and the universities before that. So now, you know, you're a poker player. You're a little, you're playing poker.
Semi-pro, yeah. It's like on the side.
Whether you're pro or not, you know how to play poker.
Yes.
And you like playing poker. And you're an investment guru, you're winning cases, and you know, you really understand like what it, to even sell those points, those concepts, or win contests, whatever it is. You're working in the field, no matter how exciting it is. And you're a libertarian. You're into Austrian economics, and you're patient. So let's turn to the book, because you're obviously primed for Bitcoin, you know. And as we turn to the book, so how did you come to Bitcoin? That kind of is in the wash here too. And so we got all, you're primed. But how do you turn to Bitcoin?
So because I was primed, as you're saying, and that's, I guess, a good way of putting it. I remember hearing about Bitcoin from, like, you know, let's call it Max Kaiser in 2011 when I was working at Macquarie, which was a full service brokerage. And, you know, me and a bunch of buddies are sort of, you know, talking, you know, we're all bouncing ideas off each other about what's going on in the world and economics and investments. We're always, you know, you're always talking macro and trying to get a sense for the lay of the land. And Bitcoin comes out or starts to at least make headlines on some of the little, you know, outlets that we were paying attention to. And, you know, we're thinking, oh, well, wouldn't it be cool if we threw a little bit of money into it. It's trading at like, you know, call it a buck. But we were just, you know, bankers. We don't know from this technology. Like I know nothing from programming and coding and all that. So like, oh, you know, it was very intimidating. Once I had the idea of, oh, let's buy. And then we're trying to look up and search, how do we actually buy? How do we actually hold it? Once we realized, okay, yeah, we're just not, you know, equipped to do this. And there was no resources available at the time, right? It was still very sparse back then. So we basically didn't act on it, watched it go from a buck to, you know, I think it was 30 bucks. That was the peak around the time that we were paying attention to it. And I thought, okay, you know, we missed the boat. And I always knew about it in the background for the next bunch of years, but I never really paid attention to it. I always knew that there were 21 million units, coins, that the coins were issued on this predetermined schedule, and that mining was somehow, you know, energy intensive or consumed energy. I didn't understand the mechanics really, other than it was costly to some degree to produce Bitcoins. And so didn't think about it. And then
when is
at the
this?
End of this, this was in 2011. That was in 2011 when I first heard about Bitcoin. But basically I didn't buy it, and because I didn't have skin in the game, I didn't really pay attention to it.
But you see it go from a dollar to 30.
Oh yeah, I saw it go from a dollar to 30, and I knew it had gone to 50 later, and to a couple hundred later, and back down, and it had yo-yoed back and forth and back and forth. But I wasn't really paying close attention to it. That I'm like, oh, this is, you know, I wasn't keeping tabs on it in the sense that, oh yeah, maybe this is something I'm going to build a career around, or something that I really need to invest in. It wasn't until the end of 2016 I bumped into a friend, just sort of by luck. And he was telling me, oh yeah, you know, he's big into Ethereum, big into crypto. And his literal words to me were, this was in December of 2016. He goes, Ethereum is the most valuable commodity in the world that no one knows about. And I was like, that's a bold statement. Sure. But okay, I'll entertain this. And so I started looking into it, and he was into Bitcoin a little bit as well. But I would say this particular person was very much more on the Ethereum side of things, much more interested in the Ethereum side of things. And so sort of by dumb luck, I started buying into both Bitcoin and Ether at the beginning of 2017, not long after I bumped into my friend, and things started taking off. There was a huge ICO boom. And, you know, if you were in the market at the time, you couldn't not be hooked. And so initially I started to think, oh yeah, blockchain is great. Blockchain does this, blockchain does that, blockchain solves everything. Like, oh, why don't we just have a blockchain for this? But as time wore on, and obviously as markets wore on too, and you know, the shine wore off of Ether and you know, the ICO and the shitcoin casino, and Bitcoin was showing its mettle, and this is sort of, if you want to call it, leading into the end of 2017, beginning of 2018, those sound money roots and the Austrian economics roots all sort of started really coming back to me. And I was really putting the pieces together, and in large part, thanks to the amazing like writers and researchers in the Bitcoin community, right? Because these guys are out there putting out articles, putting out blogs, doing interviews. And so as I'm learning and learning more, I'm connecting old dots to sort of, you know, whatever, new dots. It's not my finest analogy. But making all these connections, and once, you know, everything, once it clicked for me, I knew that, okay, like, yes, Bitcoin really is the thing, and it's there's no reason it's not going to, if you want to say, fulfill the prophecy. So yeah, I left my job. I was fortunate because I had, okay, I sort of took out this little nest egg that, okay, I'm going to use this as runway, and I'm going to create something for myself in the Bitcoin world. I don't know what that's going to be. And lo and behold, I wound up writing a book. It was never something I dreamed of doing. It's never something I imagined myself doing. But once I came to it, you know, I put my heart and soul into it, because once I made the decision to write the book, I knew I could put out something that people would gravitate towards. I just had this feeling that I could present Bitcoin in a way that was different, and that maybe would help people wrap their head around it.
Yeah, you have. It's really a fantastic book. I'm still wrapping my head around it. I've read it probably about 1.5 times now, you know, definitely once, and kind of had to run through it again to kind of just, I wanted to pick like my top 15 out of my top 50 favorite things from the book, you know, and I kind of had to go over that and narrow it down. I kind of want to start with, you know, one of the first things you say. And again, I really want to stress that there's, your words are great. And then you have this benefit of you know, stitching the chapters together through both fantastic chapter titles. Your chapter titles, from 2 to 5 or 6 words, are fantastic. And then the quotes, a lot of them are really, half of them maybe are not even Bitcoin, which I love, because they shed light on money and Bitcoin or life, whatever it is. So let's get into it. These are your words, though. And I'm going to key in on this particular sentence, because I think it reflects a lot of what we already talked about, which is, to tell of Bitcoin is to tell of just such a legendary tale defined by a single constant characteristic, stoicism. You know, I'm already thinking of you as the, you know, the Bitcoin stoic. There's a lot of patience.
Don't do that. If you know me in person, man, I'm like, I can't sit still. I'm bouncing off the walls. I stoic. Right, right. I feel like.
Well, you know,
it's only up here. Yeah.
Well, but then you're painting Bitcoin as very stoic.
Yes. Very,
you know,
much
and
so.
That's what's coming through. And it's something we kind of you really drive at a lot through the words of patience and stoicism and the quotes. And one of the things, you kind of compare Bitcoin to a lighthouse, which I really loved. And maybe you could kind of talk a little bit about that. Like, how is Bitcoin like a lighthouse? Why do we have to bend to Bitcoin?
Yeah, for sure. So I think it's in that same chapter that you're referring to, yep, where you read, it's sort of at the beginning of the book where I say that Bitcoin is a lighthouse in the sense that the closer you get to it and the more you understand it, the more its surroundings are revealed, right? So if you're way in the distance on a ship and you see this tiny little light, well, it's something you recognize that, okay, land is in the distance there, but you don't know what the actual terrain is. And then as you get closer and closer, you're seeing more and more of what's actually in front of you. And so that's the way I was sort of teeing up Bitcoin in the book, is that it's not just one thing that you need to understand about Bitcoin. Predominantly Bitcoin is money, but money is also many things, and you can approach it from many angles and understand it in many different ways. And so I wanted to start by sort of saying, listen, as you get further into the book, I'm basically foreshadowing with that line that as you get further into the book, you should start to see more and more of what Bitcoin is or what Bitcoin can be.
Right. You know, it's interesting too, you compare Bitcoin to like an adventure novel, like Choose Your Own Adventure, which is kind of what you're talking about, how like it reveals itself slowly. It's kind of like a Rorschach test. Everyone kind of sees it a little differently at first and gets different things out of it, because of basically, I think, use cases. Why do you need Bitcoin? You know,
it was also a little bit, sorry to interrupt you. It was also a little bit of, again, sort of foreshadowing. I was very careful with all the words I chose in the book, because I really wanted people to make connections, like have their sort of synapses be firing as they're reading the book. And, you know, if you're going back and you're reading the book and you go, oh, it's sort of like a choose your own adventure novel, right? I'm telling you on the first couple pages, this book is, you know, or Bitcoin is sort of like a choose your own adventure novel. I'm also sort of telling you that the book is a little bit of a choose your own adventure novel. Yeah, you read it through the first time.
I didn't think of that.
I obviously recommend you read it in order, but then you can go back at any time to learn about any particular point, and you can sort of pick right up and feel like you're not missing anything.
That's true. I didn't think of that, because I'm a A to Z kind of guy. But yeah, I can see that now. You know, some of these like great chapter headings, like The Root of All Good. And you know, you had this great Ayn Rand quote, so you think that money is the root of all evil. Have you ever asked, what is the root of money? You know, and
very important question.
Yeah, why do you think people don't really question, you know, the root of money?
As someone who studied economics, you know, 13 years ago in school, you know, we don't get into it. Like, that's a topic that is, you know, brushed, just skimmed at the edges, that money is this thing that, okay, central banks control it and they add money when they need and they take away when they need. And it's assumed that that process is just smooth and fine and there's no issues. No, yeah, they adjust the interest rate when the economy needs it and so on. So, but what we don't get into is, you know, how did they come to get the authority to issue money and set interest rates? Why is money valuable in the first place? Or why is this particular medium, you know, our dominant money in the first place? We don't really go into that in economics. It's just sort of taken for granted. It's an assumption. And I talk about, to some, in at some point in the book, how we've all sort of just grown up with money being what it was, being what it is. It's, we work for money, we invest money, we all use money every day. As you grow up, you get your allowance, you get a couple quarters or a buck, and you go buy a chocolate bar, and okay, that's your first experience with money. And so, okay, now I know what money is. And it becomes this assumption in everything we do, when in fact, it's the biggest variable of everything that's going on in the world.
Yeah. I really like how you also say, you know, if the internet is the protocol for the free exchange of information, then Bitcoin can be thought of as the protocol for the free exchange of value.
And I can't take credit for that one. That was someone else on Bitcoin put that out long before me.
Fair enough. But then let's just dive into that point. Like, because this is one I'm really trying to like get through in my mind. Like, how is Bitcoin, you know, an exchange of value, and why is that valuable?
Well, money is an exchange of value, right? Hmm. It's just we've taken for granted what the actual value proposition is. So all I'm saying in that is that the same way we can move information around, Bitcoin, well, it's also just information, but that information happens to have a monetary premium, right? It happens to have financial value. And so now we have this means of transferring value around the internet without interference.
Mm. And what do you think about the interplay with Bitcoin and energy? And you kind of touch on how like Thomas Edison and Henry Ford like endorsed this idea of money created from energy.
It was fascinating to sort of uncover that. Oh, this is not a totally new idea. Right, right. Money from energy. But Bitcoin is executed differently than, you know, Buckminster Fuller or Thomas Edison would have envisioned, because they envisioned actually sending energy around. But, you know, that's basically not possible, because you can't send a physical full, you know, unit of energy, kilowatt, whatever, you know, from Toronto to Japan or something. It's not going to travel. And so this is sort of the next best thing, where in a sense we've bottled energy's value, and you can send that representation of its value to be unleashed later on. It's not that you're unleashing actual energy, but it can purchase or you know, it be traded for that commensurate value of energy, if you want to think of it that way.
Yeah.
But just energy being something that's commoditized and something that, you know, everyone can recognize is valuable. We all use it. So it's on a level footing for everyone. Like, it had that basis for why it could be good money, but it was just, yeah, you couldn't actually execute it.
Yeah.
That's money.
I'd love to ask you about absolute scarcity. And in reference to Bitcoin, and you know, what makes Bitcoin so scarce? Is it the 21 million, or is it a little bit something else?
Yeah, it's for me, it's more than the 21 million. The 21 million is one system, right? The Bitcoin network is this one network. It had this immaculate inception, where there was no precedent for it to come into existence. It did against, you know, any number of odds and, you know, drawbacks and attacks and what have you. It has managed to maintain and get more robust as it grows. But it is the network itself that is the singular, unique, scarce thing that's one of a kind, right? We created digital scarcity, and you know, a lot of different speakers in the space talk about this.
Yeah, but I like how you...
Whether Satoshi picked 21 million or 100 million, it wouldn't have mattered. It's the fact that the network is scarce. That's the most important thing.
Yeah. I like how you know, one of your chapters, what the fiat, empty promises.
That was my favorite.
Empty promises. You know, and the debts and lies are generally mixed together. Francois Rabelais, Renaissance writer and physician. I thought that was really, you know, a great quote. And it kind of, what do you think of inflation and, you know, where things are going and your take on it? Like, I know most Bitcoiners have a take on it, but I want to hear yours, you know, like.
Yeah, for sure. Well, inflation today maybe is a little different than classical inflation, right? Classical inflation is sort of money was measured by the money supply, whereas today inflation is measured by prices. Mm. But the actual, you know, recipe for how we measure prices is changed from time to time. And so you're not measuring apples to apples year over year. You're measuring apples to oranges year over year, which is not a measure of anything worthwhile. And so that's a word, I guess, on the measurement of inflation. So the measurement itself is flawed. But then inflation, in my experience, I guess it manifests in different ways, right? When we have money printing, it comes up, you know, regulations and policies and banks, they guide capital to a certain extent. So, right, we see real estate as one of the asset stocks or one of the assets that really benefit from inflation. We don't see inflation. Maybe I shouldn't say we don't see inflation because there's probably no example I can think of something that isn't going up, but it's uneven, right? It's uneven. And so regardless of how it's distributed, though, it is insidious because it's definitely outpacing our ability to earn, and only a select few are really able to keep up with it or outpace it. And it just creates inequality. Like at the end of the day, we are creating more and more wealth inequality when we have more and more, you know, if we want to call it inflation or money printing or what have you. Right. And that's the biggest, I mean, that's one of the big problems. I shouldn't say the biggest. There's lots of problems.
I like this, another chapter titled Bitcoin on Point in Good Time. Patience is a conquering virtue, Geoffrey Chaucer. I'm curious, like, you know, you codified a lot of knowledge in here and interesting thoughts and historical facts. You did a magnificent job of like kind of condensing and make it really concise, easy to read, approachable from all different levels, and a lot of valuable for all different, you know, people and levels. What do you think you learned about Bitcoin, that's, whether it's in the book or not, you know, through this process? Because, you know, maybe you were bringing all this knowledge into it, but then when you wash and rinse it together, I'm wondering, you know, what kind of synergy happened for you, or what have been some of your takeaways?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. I would say I had the broad strokes of the arguments down sort of before I started. I had roughly sketched out the topics and maybe some of the resources I was going to lean on to help draw in and create the arguments that I thought I wanted to create. They definitely changed as I went along. Some of it anyway, not all of it, but some of it changed as I went along. In terms of what I learned, I mean, I learned about every aspect that I wrote about, if I'm being totally honest. Like, maybe money is the one that I didn't learn as much about because that was sort of my bread and butter coming into this. But all in all, like, all this did, the experience of writing the book and going down the rabbit hole of every topic that I went down, at the end of the day, all it did was solidify my conviction in Bitcoin. Like, I have far less qualms about it than I did even 2 years ago, where I might have thought, oh, this could be a problem or that could be a problem, whether it's, oh, mining is centralized in China, or, oh, energy, you know, the energy consumption is boiling the oceans. Like, those got dispelled, you know, as concerns from my mind as I researched. And so now, I feel very comfortable thinking about Bitcoin and what it can be and what it likely will become because of that experience.
Yeah. Part of the journey, I'm thinking, so now you squeeze all this juice into the book, and you're learning yourself, you're kind of bringing it all together, you're building out your knowledge, and then you release it into the world, and now you're, you know, a public Bitcoiner. How much fun has it been, or just what has it been like to go from, you know, Bitcoiner, you know, zealot to public Bitcoiner?
Well, yeah, I feel like we're sort of sharing the journey together in a certain extent, right?
We are.
I agree. I'm not mistaken, your podcast launched right around the same time my book came out.
Within days, in either direction.
Within days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I love seeing your book come out. It made me feel like, hey, I'm doing something. Like, let's all get in it. The space is going to get bigger. And it was reassuring to me to see you come out with your book and then have the success you've been having, get the positive feedback. So, how's that been?
Yeah, I mean, I was nervous for sure before I released the book, not just because I had poured every ounce of, you know, energy and care that I had into it. But I was nervous. How would Bitcoiners receive it, right? Like, I was hoping that people who, you know, whether it's podcast hosts that who I've been listening to their interviews, or, you know, writers in the space, some of whom are quoted in the book. I've got lots of names either in the book or in the back of the book of guys who I'm trying to acknowledge them, because like this book is impossible without a lot of these guys, the guys and girls. But yeah, I was very nervous when it came out, but the reception has been like fantastic. It seems that everyone who's read it is just like, yes, you're making things so much easier in terms of, you know, I would have these thoughts in my head. I had these arguments, and suddenly I can explain it within a couple paragraphs, or you explained it in a couple paragraphs. So to have people sort of think of it, not just as, oh, it's a great read, but now it's all, you know, start to finish, like you said, but it can also be a great resource. And that was a bit of an idea I had, but I don't think I really realized the gravity of it until it sort of came out. And I've had a couple people make comments to me about the fact that, oh yeah, like I want to go back and just refresh myself on this topic. And it's like two pages, and I can just get the full breadth of it and feel like I have a grasp on, oh yeah, this is why, you know, this aspect is the way it is.
Yeah. You have another,
so that's been great.
You have another, a great chapter title, Time is Money, Scarcity Abides, like the dude. and then it goes into the quote, many people take no care of their money till they come nearly to the end of it, and others do just the same with their time. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, writer and statesman. What has been the reaction maybe from like not Bitcoiners, pre-coiners or no coiners, even in your personal life or anything like to the book? What has been some of the reactions?
Yeah, I mean, as you'd expect, it's mixed, because some people read it and it doesn't hit the way I hope it would hit. And that's bound to happen. I knew that was going to happen. But for the people that it does hit, oh man, it's been really cool. I've had a couple people either tell me, or I've heard from word of mouth, that, oh, so-and-so read the book and he won't shut up about it. Like he's just telling everyone about it. So like when you hear stuff like that, that just, you know, it makes my day.
Yeah,
because I'm hopefully changing people's lives, right? The goal of it is, yes, I want to sell books, sure, but I want to get the word out about Bitcoin. I want to do it in this fun, friendly way that is also, you know, educational and will really make you consider things in a different way. And if I can switch a few light bulbs on for some people, then like, then I'm doing my job. That makes me happy.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great. Another one, time is money, use it wisely. Nowadays, people know the price of everything and the value of nothing, by Oscar Wilde. I think that like really describes Bitcoin in a lot of ways. People just don't know how to value their own time, their future selves. I don't want to say they don't know how. I don't want to speak for other people, but I feel like just people aren't, you know, kind of beyond Bitcoin, just really taking the most for their time and their future selves and take care of themselves.
And in part, that's because our self-worth has been devalued by fiat, right? By living in a fiat world, we sort of realize that we have to work that much harder to get that much extra value out of everything we do. And then once we get it, holding on to it is a whole other challenge, right? That's where Bitcoin really shines, obviously, is that, okay, you know, I'm going to preserve you know, I guess whether it's re-love or, you know, my life force, sorry, Michael Saylor, I'm going to preserve my life force, right? My previous efforts in this system, in these coins that are scarce and that I can realistically expect to be around for a very long time and be just as scarce in the future.
Right.
Which is something we can't do with fiat. We're constantly feeling this hole being burnt in our pockets, right? Like every time we have cash, every time we have savings, it's like, well, I can't sit on this. It's that melting ice cube again, as you know, Saylor said, like it's this melting ice cube. I got to invest it, but investing includes risk, and people take risk because they have to. Now, most people are risk averse, right? Most people don't want risk, but there's been no zero risk asset, right? We've completely destroyed what money is, the concept of money, the savings purpose of money. And so we can't save money as a risk-free thing. Okay, bonds used to be less risky, but now you're getting zero interest on them. Stocks are overvalued. Real estate's overvalued. Gold, who knows? Also, you know, I own gold, and I look at it every day as like, well, this is just a pet rock. What have I done? Like, yeah, you know, I bought it before Bitcoin was even, you know, alive. So I've been in the gold game a little while. But yeah, it's like I look at it as, well, this is sort of dead weight now. Am I, you know, what am I going to do with this? Because I know that's not the future. I know
right,
it's not.
Right.
So yeah, it's like putting it all together is just, it's super interesting.
Yeah, it is. I love the book. And I want to know, because I think the book makes me optimistic. I think you're very optimistic. What do you think is the most optimistic thing about Bitcoin for the next 5 years? And you know, price or anything else, doesn't have to be about price, but like, what jazzes you the most, either personally or for the world or anything? Or you can longer. You could go longer out if you want.
Yeah, I would, you know, whether, let's say 5 to 10 year kind of thing. It's definitely the mindset change that it is forcing upon people, right? You don't change Bitcoin, Bitcoin changes you, right? That's, you know, one of the mottos, I guess. And so a couple years ago, it would have been unfathomable that, oh, you know, all these billionaires and institutions are going to want to store Bitcoin and own Bitcoin and offer Bitcoin. And now it's like no one can get enough, right? You know, everyone needs to be involved in it because it's the thing. So what will happen as a result of that? I'm very fascinated to see that play out as to, okay, if banks, especially in the US, not so much in Canada, at least not yet, but if banks really start to say, okay, we're going to get in the game of custodying Bitcoin for our clients, and we're going to do it because if the Fed tries to come up with this central bank digital currency, they're basically going to nationalize banks. Like the bread and butter of banks is going to be gone. So they need some other angle. So like it is literally changing the dynamic of the financial landscape. And that's going to change the dynamic of, you know, our social landscape. And so I'm just very excited to see that play out. Yes, I'm super optimistic about what Bitcoin is and what it can do if it becomes that, you know, the words I use are that preferred basis for commerce. If it's that, you know, as Raoul Powell said, if it becomes that pristine asset that when all else fails, that's the thing you want to have. The ramifications of that and doing business on that. And okay, if I'm going to relinquish my Bitcoin, if I'm going to give it to you, I better damn well get great value in return. Right. Yeah, like that's the mindset is if you want some Bitcoin, if you want to get earned some Bitcoin, you know, earn is the word, right? You don't just get it for free. There's no just creating it from nothing. You're going to pay a price, whether it's in finance, you know, dollars, or whether it's in, you know, mining energy, or whether it's, you know, you're earning it by putting in work some way, somehow.
Right.
And getting paid in it.
Yeah, man. I love the book, Magic Internet Money, a book about Bitcoin. From the freshest new public Bitcoiner, I'll be your wingman any day, Jesse Berger. I can't wait to the second book. you know, I think you have a lot more to come, and maybe it'll take you a few minutes to squeeze out some more juice. But I think there's more in here, and I think you're going to take some of these thoughts even further, which are going to be really a fun ride.
I have no idea what's coming next for me just yet. I'm you know, part of finishing the book was okay, I can finally catch my breath and try to figure out, you know, what comes next. And you know, I don't know if there's a part two for the book. This was definitely meant to be, you know, my Mona Lisa, my Sistine Chapel. It's the best that I have to offer.
That's great, man. And I know you have a lot more to offer. This has been awesome. Please let everyone know where they could find you and where they could buy the book. Obviously on Amazon, on Twitter, but if you can go over the details and let everyone know where they can find you.
Yeah, for sure. You can visit www.magicbitcoinbook.com, and there you can find links to Amazon, Kobo, any other e-reader platform that I'm on. Ultimately, I will do an Audible. A lot of people are asking for an Audible. I'm going to get there. It's been hectic getting the book out the door, and now I'm sort of on this world virtual tour. Press tour, I guess, for the book, which has been a lot of fun. So yeah, there's that. You can follow me on Twitter at Jayberjay, Jayberjay. And yeah, I'd love to talk to anyone who's either read the book. If you've read the book, please write a review for the book. Those help me a lot. So please, if you can write a review, that's fantastic.
Let's get the word out. Everyone write a review. Well, read the book first. You know, I can't wait for the Audible. I think that's going to be dope. There's just so much, you know, amazing quotes and great words from you. I think Kindles are great, but like I recommend people get the paperback. The artwork is really cool. There's lots of little Easter eggs in there, and I think it comes a little bit more to life in your hand, and it's great to hand out when you're done reading it to some, you know, maybe pre-coiners or no coiners. So
yeah, like I said, there's I definitely, you know, I baked a lot of Bitcoin culture into the book in terms of And the Easter eggs are partially Bitcoin, and there's a whole bunch of other ones, and I've scattered them everywhere. And the artwork, the part of the art was that all of the pieces of the art actually sort of work together with the words in the book and with the other pieces of art. If you, you know, again, it was about really connecting the dots and getting those sort of synapses firing for people. So literally cover to cover, front to back, it was all meant to work as one sort of seamless whole.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I just really hope people check it out and enjoy it. And
you pulled it off in spades. It's a great book.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
I really hope people, you know, pick it up and buy it and read it and learn. It's great. And I think it's for everybody. So this has been so dope, Jesse. I hope to talk to you soon.
Yeah, man. It's been a pleasure. We'll do it again sometime.
Jesse Berger going all in on Bitcoin magic right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And thank you for listening. If you dig the chats, vote with those thumbs and press 5 stars in the app and subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel. That's the best way to get the word out so we can keep grinding out thought-provoking conversations about Bitcoin and magic. This is Sed. Peace out.